Hare Krishna. Redefining success is the topic for this evening. And to begin, I'll ask you a very simple question. If I had a bank, I don't, just an example, and I came to you canvassing for some deposits, and I assured you with all the emphasis at my command, please put your money in my bank and I assure you the bank's going to fail. Are you going to put your money in my bank? No. The answer is so obvious that you didn't even bother saying yes. Well, let's take it another way. Let's say I had a boat and you wanted to cross the river. And I said, please hop onto my boat and I assure you that this boat will capsize midway because it's got a hole. Please step in to my boat. Will you step in? Of course, no. Why am I giving these examples? Because that is precisely what we are doing in this world. How so? This body that we have, which naturally we are so attached to, for which we take so much pain, whose every desire we try to fulfill, who we pamper day and night with all sorts of good food, good resting facilities, good clothing, etc. This very body, which also gives us so much pain, gives us disease, gets old, and ultimately dies, we are investing everything into this body. And the whole world functions according to this idea. This body is very valuable. And by body, I also mean the subtler aspects of the body, like the mind, the intelligence. The ancient Indian text Bhagavad Gita also recognizes the mind and intelligence to be a part of the body, but they are subtle parts of the body. Modern science visualizes the mind and intelligence as being part of the physical brain. And modern medical science understands thoughts, emotions, feelings, etc., as being merely electrochemical reactions and processes going on within the brain, the firing of neurons and this and that. But from Bhagavad Gita, we understand that the mind and the intelligence are very subtle. They're not gross, tangible things like the brain or the rest of the body. But in any case, we all think that we want to get pleasure for this body, for this mind, and for this intelligence. So depending on where we are in life, we imagine success to be what will give us the maximum pleasure, the maximum satisfaction. If I'm more rooted in the bodily concept of life, meaning that I understand myself to be this body, physical body, then I will give a lot of emphasis to physical pleasure and to everything that can bring me that physical pleasure, whether it is good clothing, whether it is good food, or any other form of physical pleasure. And then my standard of success will be calculated according to how much I have been able to achieve that. If I'm at a slightly different level, let's say the level of the mind and intelligence, especially of the intelligence, then I might construe success as being some kind of intellectual pursuit. Let's say I'm a poet, I'm a writer, I'm a philosopher, I'm a scientist, or I want to crack some mystery in some philosophical issue or some branch of knowledge. So I feel it's success to be able to do that. So depending on whether we think we are the body, the mind, the intelligence, etc., we have our own definitions of success. And therefore, motivational speakers will often say, chase your dream. Yes, you hear that slogan sometimes? Find your own dream in life, or find your own meaning or purpose in life. So chasing a dream, unfortunately, perhaps it's not realized how true is the words they're saying. It is indeed a dream. Because in the Bhagavad Gita, we are told that we are not these bodies. We are not the mind. We are not the intelligence. We are eternal spiritual sparks. We are spiritual souls. Actually, we have nothing to do with this body. Somehow or the other, that eternal spiritual spark, in Sanskrit called the Atma, is trapped in this material body. And because we identify due to ignorance with this body, mind and intelligence, so we forget our eternal spiritual identity. Real happiness, real success lies in identifying ourselves as spiritual entities, not as material entities. And then in acting on that platform. Sometimes people ask us, what is your definition of spirituality? Well, spirituality is a process of trying to understand one's own true identity and then acting on that platform in pursuance of that understanding. So we are the spirit souls. So if our knowledge is based only on matter, we will have one understanding of success, and that's the general understanding in the world. But if we have a spiritual understanding of life, of our identity, then our goal of life will be different. And then our measure of success will also be different. Just before coming here, I googled a bit. Some confession. And do you know what I googled for? Successful people who commit suicide, who committed suicide. And I was surprised to see such a long list. I didn't have the time to go through the list because I had to hurry to come here. And I listed down a few names. Yeah? Shall I read them out for you? Not that I'm taking pleasure in it, but it's just a fact that is unfortunate, actually. There's such a long list, I'll tell you just five or six, maybe seven, eight names. Robin Williams, a great, a very famous comedian, humorist, brought smiles and laughs into the lives of many people. But there's a difference between humor and happiness, you know. If someone cracks jokes and makes people laugh, it doesn't mean that one becomes happy just by laughing at jokes. So there's a difference between humor and happiness. So here's someone who brought humor into people's lives. And perhaps the people who were laughing at his performances felt they were happy. But even they were not happy, neither was he. Happy people don't commit suicide. And let's go back to the olden times. Cleopatra of Julius Caesar fame. Eratosthenes, a famous Greek mathematician. Le Corbusier, the famous architect. Marilyn Monroe, famous film actress, known for her liaison with John F. Kennedy. And then I came across an interesting entry called the Mysterious Club of 27. Have you heard of it? This is a group of rock stars, rock music stars in the 60s, maybe 70s also, all of whom died primarily of drug overdose at the age of 27. All of them died at 27. And there was some music star who died just a few years ago, maybe one or two decades ago, at 27. And it is widely perceived that he wanted to join this club. So he also committed suicide at 27. And there are names. I don't listen to rock music. But I just want to tell you what I read from the internet before you start saying things. Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, and some others, and many others. Some painters like Van Gogh, and writers like Ernest Hemingway, and many, many others. They include artists, sculptors, painters, writers, poets, philosophers, intellectuals, film stars, music stars, industrialists, all sorts of people who have attained unrivaled fame in this world and success. I will share with you one personal experience I had of a friend from my school days. He was brilliant, always a topper in class. He was really brilliant. Passed out of school. He was a topper in the entire country, if not the state. We were together also in 2 years, just before university. And then he went into one of the most prestigious technical universities in India. In the first year, he topped. Because you know this was an elite university, so you had the best brains coming there. The toppers from everywhere coming there together. And he topped in the first year. In the second year, he came second. And he hung himself. In his hostel room, there was a fan, a ceiling fan. So he hung himself in the hostel room because he couldn't take it. Now, second, standing number two in that kind of group was some achievement. But it wasn't enough for him. He was successful all through. But he was miserable because not only did he come second, but there was this enormous pressure that he had to remain number one. There are various studies that people have done about why successful people commit suicide. And psychologists have come up with many answers. One of them is the pressure to remain successful. Another is the pressure to make it look as if it's so easy. And it's effortless. It's just, I'm just like that. Whereas there's a lot of hard work, there's a lot of pain and sweat and blood that goes behind it. But the idea you want to show that it's just easy for me to be successful. And there are many other reasons. Often, successful people, by successful I mean materially successful people, commit suicide because they're not happy with their achievements, they're restless. They're dissatisfied in spite of gain and success. So obviously there's a difference between accomplishment and real success. You see, if you look at a dictionary, success is defined as the accomplishment of a certain goal or an aim. And there's a distinction between accomplishment and success. Accomplish means to attain a certain goal. Let's say you want to make $1 million in 5 years. But success refers to the quality of that outcome. Once you get those $1 million, first of all, you might not, in which case there's misery, there's frustration. But even if you do get that $1 million, will you be happy? Will you be satisfied now that you've achieved your goal? You've accomplished your target, but you're not happy. Therefore, you're not successful. So in your success lies your failure. This is one of my favorite incidents that I like to narrate. Some years ago, there was a television interview in the US with a person who was, at that time, this was several years ago, he was the fourth richest person in the world. And he was so rich that you could practically not compute what his wealth was. Because by the time you calculated it, his wealth had already increased more. So in the interview, he was asked so many questions about business and about this and that. And finally, the lady who was interviewing him asked him, she said, okay, one final question. Now, you've achieved everything in life. You're one of the most successful persons in the whole world. Tell me, if God were to appear before you, what would you ask him for? It's a question that we can all think about. If God were to appear before us at this moment, what would we ask him? And pat came the reply without any hesitation. Just a little happiness. So who's speaking? A person who is the fourth richest man in the world. It's easy to understand that people who are unsuccessful commit suicide. Let's say there's some big economic depression or a recession. People have lost their jobs. They've got loans to pay and they don't have money to look after themselves and their family. Or they've gone through some big humiliation in life. Or they've been failures at everything. So it's sad, but it's understandable that these people commit suicide. But when people who are quote-unquote successful commit suicide, then we have to sit up and take notice. And it's not a new phenomenon. It's been happening. It's been happening from time immemorial. But one tends to notice that these things have increased of late in the last century or so. Why so? I would hazard by saying that it's because we have become more and more materialistic. We have become more and more body-centered and world-centered as opposed to spirit-centered. Therefore, in our mistaken search for happiness, we wrongly designate success as something which it isn't. You know, success is something that should be long-lasting. Normal success that we have in the world, you know, you can be a millionaire, but for how long? Maybe for some time, and then maybe you lose your money. Or maybe you've made a lot of money, but then you die at the end of it. So from a higher spiritual point of view, we look at success as something that is not only long-lasting and permanent, but that is of a superior quality than ordinary success of this world. Ordinary success is usually driven by some materialistic motive. It's centered on something that is selfish, generally. And it's short-lived. So what is real success? Real success is something that goes beyond that. I started out with the analogy or the example of the bank and the boat. Well, what if we had something like this in our life, where the success that we achieved could continue and sustain forever and ever? But that's not possible, because in this world, everything eventually comes to an end. The Bhagavad Gita says that we are spiritual entities, and therefore, because of our spiritual nature, we can never actually be successful, never be happy in materialistic pursuits. When we focus our attention only on the material, then our success is bound to be a failure. It is bound to be a cause of unhappiness and distress, as indeed we see with all these famous and successful personalities. You know, in this world, we see variety, isn't it? Someone is very intelligent, someone's not so intelligent, someone's born in a wealthy family, someone's not. Someone has musical talent, someone doesn't. Someone is born beautiful, someone isn't. There's unlimited variety and diversity in this world. Some may call it disparity. Indeed, nature has inequality programmed into it. We are not equal. You're more intelligent than me. What to do? You're born with that higher intelligence. I'm not. But that's the way we are. You're more beautiful than me. So that's the nature. This nature has created us like that. Now, we may attempt by various ways to counteract what nature has done, but the fact remains that there is this diversity. Why is it being of such a phenomenon of nature? Actually, from Bhagavad Gita, we understand that the soul occupies this body. And when this body is destroyed, it moves on to another body. When that body is destroyed, it moves on to yet another body, and another, and another. And this is called a cycle of birth and death. The eternal soul has to move from body to body, experience to experience, from species to species. It's not necessary that we have to be only within the human form of life. If our karma has been such that we deserve to be born in an animal body, we will be animals in the next life. If our karma is such that we have to be insects or trees in the next life, then so shall we become. So where is this idea of success? Let's say I've become a very successful person by material estimation. I've become a billionaire, the most famous person in the world, and then I die, and because of my karma, I become a cat in the next life. Or I become an insect or a tree in the next life. There are numerous such instances that are mentioned in the scriptures from India, the ancient Sanskrit scriptures like Bhagavad Gita, the Srimad Bhagavatam. These are laws of nature. So one has to see success from a larger point of view, from a longer time perspective, not just from the perspective of this little life of 40, 50, 70, 80 years. What is the meaning of success if it is just transitory, if it is just so short-lived? If somebody becomes a millionaire, you invest in my bank, the same bank that I talked about earlier, and I say, I'll make you a millionaire in one day, but the next day you lose all your millions. So what's the fun of being a millionaire one day and then losing all your millions the next day? Does it make any sense? So similarly, because this material body is temporary and we accomplish so many things, even if we are successful, and then we lose it all. And we start from scratch, probably minus in the next life. Just because one dies a millionaire doesn't mean one will be born a millionaire in the next life. One could even be born as an animal or a bird. So we really have to rethink our ideas of success. Success also has a quality that goes with it. Even those who may not be spiritually inclined, but who have some higher sensibilities, who are sensitive people, they understand that success doesn't lie in merely acquiring tangible assets like money or in maximizing physical pleasures. It doesn't even lie in intangibles like fame and name and prestige in this world, but it lies in things like values. What kind of values do you have in life? So that's definitely a step up. It's something wonderful. That's nice. Yes, you have sublime values. But what are those values based on? Are they based on eternal principles? Are they based on ideas that are sustainable, that will last? Will they form the foundation for success that will go on and never end? Don't we want happiness, benefit, pleasure, success that will be everlasting? Why should we settle for something that is short-lived when we have a choice? That is where the Bhagavad Gita comes in. It tells us, yes, you are not meant to be here just to be satisfied with some trifling pleasures and momentary successes of this world. That's not for you. You're not meant for that. You're a spiritual entity and your goals are very high. You're meant for eternity. You're meant for immortality. You're not meant to die. You're not meant to grow old and get diseased. You're not meant to get insulted and humiliated in this world. You're meant to be free. Real freedom doesn't lie in whimsically rebelling against established norms. Real freedom doesn't come just by doing whatever we like without restrictions. In general, in the modern world, we don't like restrictions. And we consider that as an infringement on our freedom. And we resist that. So the concept of freedom that people have in the world today is that we should all be allowed to do whatever we like, subject to the condition that we don't harm other people. So the concept of freedom is limited to my freedom of actions, that I don't want any rules, any regulations, any freedoms imposed on me. But actually, this is very dangerous because it means that we are overlooking the fact that there are laws of nature. Let's say there's a football match. You know, sometimes people say, I'm all right for spirituality, but I don't want to follow any rules. Don't tell me I should do this, I shouldn't do that, I don't like these things. I want to do what I want to do. So why should you follow rules? Actually, I give them the example of a football match, or what do you call it here, footy? Yes, footy? Footy or rugby, or whatever it is that you call it here. And so it's a pretty rough game. I was passing by one time on a last visit in a ground. It's a little rough, yes. So, yes, you're playing a game, and every now and then the referee blows a whistle, and everything stops and then starts again. And then someone says, you know, this is such a botheration. You know, why does the referee stop us? We should just be allowed to do whatever we like. You know, why the restriction on our freedoms? We want to just go with the ball and score the goal. And if everyone thinks like that and no one follows any rules, then what's going to happen on that field? There's going to be real chaos. So because everybody voluntarily agrees to follow certain rules, and there is someone to implement those rules, to enforce them, therefore there is some semblance of order. Some success can be achieved. Yes, one group fails, the other succeeds, the other is victorious. But at least the game goes on. There's success in completing the game. Similarly, if you're driving, if you say, you know, I just want to be free. I am a free bird. I want to drive any way I like. Imagine what's going to happen on the streets. There will be chaos, destruction. So freedom doesn't mean freedom to do whatever we like without any restrictions. Intelligence means to understand that freedom implies voluntary acceptance of restrictions for a higher sublime goal. In order that I may start out in my car and reach my destination safely and in time, I follow the rules. If I don't follow the rules and nobody follows the rules, there's likelihood of accidents and then I won't reach my destination. So because I want to reach that ultimate destination, apart from the fact that it's just civilized, I follow rules and regulations. So no successful person has become successful without discipline, without accepting voluntarily restrictions and rules. Look at the Olympic athletes. Look at other sports people, even musicians. Any accomplishment requires hard work and discipline. So success cannot be seen just in terms of attaining this kind of freedom. So when we think we are free and we want to do whatever we like, there are no laws of nature acting upon us, that's what we think, then we're actually restrained further in our freedom. So let's say, as a human being, I say, well, I'm a free human and I want to do whatever I like, and by the laws of karma, then I become an animal in the next life. Then what happens? Whatever freedom I had in the human form of life is now taken away. The animals have lesser freedom than we do. The lower the species of life, the lesser the degree of freedom they have to act in this world. The humans represent the pinnacle of life forms on earth. Because humans have the highest intelligence, humans have the highest freedom to use or to misuse that intelligence. So if we think of success in terms of doing whatever we like, then we are going to end up in a situation where there will be a lot of chaos. So the Bhagavad Gita tells us, no, there's something called the regulative principles of freedom. You follow certain restrictions on yourself to attain some successful completion of your aims and goals. But if those goals are set in matter, within the material world, then even if you achieve them, what's the good? Why not achieve something which will take us beyond death? That is the question. That is real success. Success which is eternal. Even if our values are good, but if they are rooted in a lack of spiritual consciousness, still they will not enable us to attain the ultimate success. So true success has to be defined in terms of spiritual attainments as opposed to material accomplishments. And what do we mean by spiritual attainments? We mean that we actually realize, not just intellectually, but experientially, our identity as spirit souls. In the Bhagavad Gita, the speaker, Krishna, who is a supreme soul, the origin of everything material and spiritual, under whose superintendence this whole world is functioning, we are parts and parcels of Him. The word Krishna means all attractive. And we are parts and parcels of that all attractive supreme personality. Whatever we are able to do in this world, whatever success, opulence, etc. we are able to do in this world is because that has been granted to us by that supreme will according to our karma. As spiritual entities, we have a relationship of love with Krishna. But we have forgotten that. Having forgotten that, we are here in this material world going through this cycle of birth and death, one miserable situation after another. And the happiness of this world is not really happiness, but it is merely a forgetfulness of our pains. A brief period where we somehow or the other are not overcome with pain and suffering. That brief relief from suffering is our idea of happiness. We go to movies, we go to various other forms of enjoyment just so that we can be in a different world. That's the dream world. But to revive that eternal relationship of the soul to Krishna and to develop true love, true happiness, and eternal life, that is the ultimate success of life. Then the soul doesn't have to take birth again in this material world. There is a spiritual world that's beyond this material world, where everything is made of spiritual substance. Now, this is not a sectarian idea. It is not the monopoly of a particular religious denomination or a caste or a creed or some nationality or something like that. These are eternal principles of spiritual knowledge. And they are valuable and they pertain to everyone. They are accessible to everyone. This is real success. When we can attain eternal life, eternal bliss, eternal knowledge. What more success can be than that? This material world is designed for failure. It's not designed for success. Because ultimately death is a reality of life. Many times when we speak of death, people say, you people are really pessimistic. Why do you speak so much about death? It's not that we like to speak about death, but it's just that it's the reality. And knowledge means to accept the reality and see what we can do about it. Do we have a solution to the real problem of death? That is success. To conquer over death. You know, in the old times, when the sages used to visit kings, these are mentioned in various scriptures, and the kings would rise and welcome the sages and they would make them sit and speak words of respect. And then they would ask them questions. So my dear sage, are you progressing well on your path towards immortality? Are you moving ahead well? And the sage would say, yes, thank you. And my dear king, in the midst of your opulence and your power, are you also following the principles of spiritual life? Are you also moving ahead nicely on this path of spirituality? So this was the culture where everyone understood that this was the goal we all had to achieve. This was the standard of success. There were many kings who were called Raj Rishis, which means they were saintly kings. And these kings lived in enormous opulence. They had so much power. But they were trained from their young days to be detached and to be renounced when the time came. So they would perform their duties faithfully, looking after the citizens, protecting them, ensuring that their needs were fulfilled. But when the time came, they would renounce the kingdom, go into the forest to perform austerities and perform spiritual practices. The principle of yoga is quite popular these days. Yoga is a word that needs a lot of explanation, actually. There are many dimensions to yoga. And the yoga of action is important. In the yoga, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, the all-attractive one, speaks. He defines what the word yoga means. It's very interesting. Yogastha kuru karmani sangam tyaktva dhananjaya siddhya siddhyo samo bhutva samatvam yoga uchyate. This is a Sanskrit verse. I'll explain what it means. He says, be situated in yoga, my dear Arjuna, because Arjuna is Krishna's dear friend. And Krishna is speaking the Bhagavad Gita to him. He says, my dear Arjuna, be situated in yoga. Is Krishna saying to Arjuna that you should sit in some posture and then do a particular asana and then you're in yoga? He doesn't say that, no. He says, kuru karmani, do your duty. Sangam tyaktva, but be detached. Don't be attached to this, to the result of your work. And siddhi asiddhyo, samo bhutva, be equal in failure and success. Samatvam yoga muchyate. So this equanimity, this sense of being equal in success and failure is yoga. So if you want to define success in terms of yoga, this is it. While you have your spiritual objectives in life, you understand Krishna is that supreme entity whom we must try to love Because that's our constitutional position, and therein lies our ultimate success in life. But we also have to live in this world. It takes a whole lifetime of spiritual practice to attain that success. So as we work, how should we work? What should be our mentality as we do it? So Krishna says, be detached from success or failure. Do what you're meant to be doing according to the principles of dharma. Dharma are the universal principles of harmony that are mentioned in the Vedic scriptures. Work with a sense of detachment. Work as an instrument of Krishna. Work to carry out His orders, His instructions. And work as an agent with a spirit of detachment. Sometimes there may be success materially, sometimes there may be failure materially. But as you perform your duties in your material life, your job, your family, and so on, simultaneously performing your spiritual activities, then you are situated in yoga. Merely performing exercises and breathing is not yoga. It's just one part or one type of yoga. So therefore, the question arises, what kind of activities does one do? The Vedic scriptures speak about different processes for attaining ultimate spiritual success in different ages. In the bygone ages, there were periods when meditation was the way of success. After that, it was the performance of various types of ceremonies and sacrifices that was the way of success. In the previous age, it was grand worship that was the way of success. But in this age, which in Sanskrit is called Kali Yuga, which means the age of quarrel, the age of hypocrisy, the way for success, for eternal success, is to chant Krishna's names. This is called mantra meditation. It is meditation because meditation means to focus on God, to focus on something spiritual, to focus on something sublime. So when one meditates on the sound vibration, on these transcendental chants of Krishna's names, automatically one experiences an upliftment of one's consciousness. One experiences a certain degree of bliss, of joy, of spiritual understanding. And gradually, as one follows the other processes, like hearing the messages from the Bhagavad Gita and so on, then we will be well situated on the path of true success. And as far as material success, well, someone may ask, if I'm practicing spirituality as you say, is there no scope for me to try for material success? If I'm doing a business, should I not try to be successful in my business? If I'm a university student, should I not try to be successful in my examination so I get a degree? Certainly you can do that. But try to dovetail it with Krishna. To dovetail means to synchronize it. Keep in mind that ultimately that university degree or that job or that business is not independently a cause of success or happiness for you. But it is a means to an end. It's a supporting mechanism for you to enable you to continue on the path towards Krishna. Our eternal love, our eternal joy, our eternal shelter. That is the ultimate success. Thank you very much. Thank you. And I'll be happy to have any questions. Feel free to ask any questions, no holds barred. Now you have complete freedom. Yes.
You inspire us to stay detached from things that later on in a path you start, you know, losing interest and you start going back to your old habits? How do you stay in that motivated type of state?
Your question is, if we start some spiritual practices...
Yeah, and then keep going to continue that path.
Right, so you've started out on the spiritual path and you want to continue going ahead, but the old habits intervene and they pull you back from the spiritual path.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So how does one counteract that?
Yeah.
That's a very practical and important question. The only way to counteract negativity is by positivity. The only way to counteract bad habits is with good habits. You know, you can't just restrain yourself. It's hard. I mean, it's possible, but it's very hard to restrain yourself from some bad habit just like that. Unless you've developed a better habit that gives you more happiness and more satisfaction. And that in Bhagavad Gita language is called a higher taste. So when you develop good habits, then you develop that higher taste. That higher taste gives you a sense of relish, a sense of joy in your heart. It makes you immune from the infection of harassment by your old bad ways. It protects you. These good habits are like immunizing vaccines. And good habits begin with good company. That's very important. So the real formula for success is good company. If you associate with people who are spiritually inclined, very serious and sincere in their path, people who want to attain Krishna very sincerely, that's the root cause of success. It's a very important principle, a spiritual principle. Never mind what we were, what we did previously. What's done is done. Now let's look forward to a bright future. We have a bright spiritual future ahead of us. And if we come into the right company and sincerely try to follow the practices, even if sometimes we slip back into our old ways, but if we stick on to this company of spiritually minded people and are guided properly and we feel inspired by that, gradually we will be able to overcome it. It takes a little time and effort, but it will happen. And there are any number of practitioners who've gone through this journey. So there's a lot of hope there. There's a lot of positive energy there. Because this is a problem practically everyone faces in the modern world. Everyone has had some of the other bad habits, you know. But when you come to spiritual company, then we transcend that gradually. Okay? Any other questions? Yes. Okay, can I just take one question? I'll come back to you. Yeah. Hello.
Okay. Thank you, Maharaj. I was hoping you would share a little bit about your eco village in India.
Yeah, okay. All right. I'll come back to that in a few minutes.
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, you had a question?
Lucy, I'm grateful for your presence. My question is that I have known about this spirituality since a long time, but I haven't been able to choose the right path, or I haven't been the courage to take the step, because I go to some meditations and I feel some love and compassion over there, and I visit the different spiritual paths, but is there any, like, different people have different paths, or is there any one path? My first question is that, and how to find that path which is correct to you. And the other, in the bhakti, what is most important? Is the bhakti only important, or do you have to be with the bhakti with the Krishna, or with any gods?
Okay, so your first question is, that there seem to be so many spiritual paths. So which one do I take, and how do I know which is the right one?
For me.
For you, yes. So let's give the example of a pharmacy. You go to a shop that sells medicines, and there's so many medicines available there. You have an ailment. So do you just pick up any medicine? All the medicines may be bona fide. At least we hope that none of them are spurious drugs, and they're all bona fide. So they're all bona fide medicines intended to cure certain types of ailments. But you will select that medicine that is just right for you, that your doctor has prescribed for you, knowing well your condition. So similarly, there are many processes of spiritual life. And some of them may be genuine, and some of them as practiced today may not be so genuine. But even for those practices that are genuine, they may not be applicable for the modern day and age. As I mentioned briefly earlier, there are some processes that were meant for earlier ages. Silent meditation, for example, is something that's very difficult in this age to do because our mind is so restless. Our mind is not controlled, it's always agitated. Psychologists say that we think about 80,000 thoughts every day, which means practically every second our mind is hopping from one thing to the other. So since you came in for this lecture, you probably had about, I don't know how many, 60 into 60, how much is that? About 3,000 thoughts at least. Your mind has wandered. Your mind hasn't definitely 100% focused on every single word and with focus. That's the nature of the mind. So to do silent meditation is extremely difficult. Therefore, it's not recommended. So what is recommended is the sound vibration, transcendental sound of Krishna's name. So therefore, we follow that as the prescription medicine for this age. And since the prescription includes Krishna, we follow Krishna. You know, we follow the doctor's advice. That's what we do. Okay? I'll come back to the eco village at the end, maybe. Is that okay? Any other questions? Okay, so I think eco village, yes? Since you mentioned it in the introduction, yeah? I wasn't planning to speak about it, but I'm happy to share a few thoughts about it. We have this project in a certain place in South India where we want to create a village, simple village, on the lines of how people lived many, many years ago without the products of industrial civilization, no industrial products, no electricity, even solar, no tractors and bulldozers and electrical and electronic appliances, no washing machines, no refrigerators and heaters, no cement, steel, plastic. Should I go on? You're still awake? And no chemical fertilizers, no pesticides. And we live simply, very simply, so simply that many people can't stay there. We are a little fanatic, at least in that one project. But everyone who's staying there is very happy, very happy. They don't want to leave. But the difficulty is very few come there to live because they can't take the peace and quiet. The peace and quiet is too difficult to tolerate because we're so used to the hustle and bustle of the city. And one of the greatest blessings we have in the project is no electricity. So we live a very simple life. Everyone goes to bed early, rises really early by 3 a.m. And then we begin our day's work I don't stay there all the time, but very it's I visit there as much as possible when I'm in that area. And we try to be self-sufficient. We try to grow our own food. We are getting there. We haven't got there to the point of full self-sufficiency yet. Our founder, Srila Prabhupada, had a slogan that he once said, and that has been the inspiration for this project. Use what you produce and produce what you need. This was a marvelous statement, our mission statement. Use what you produce, produce what you need. So don't use anything that you can't make yourself. And don't make something that you don't really need. So your life becomes very simple and very happy. Simple living, high thinking. High thinking requires simple living. Today's society encourages high living and simple thinking. Or shall we say sinful thinking. So we have cows and bulls. We make our own cement with sand and limestone. It's not the cement that is made in factories. It's lime mortar. We make our own construction. We build our own houses with mud bricks, sun-dried bricks. We have mud mortar. We also have rocks or stones. We build with that as well. And we have simple roofs with tiles. In our kitchen, we don't use gas, liquefied petroleum gas or any such thing. We use wood stoves and very, very simple. So we don't have any major contraptions. We do have a windmill though. We were trying to get rid of the windmill finally, because we're getting there. The windmill draws water for us. So we have a water problem. Although we have heavy rainfall, but the water flows down and goes away. So we're trying to devise ways and means to conserve the water, to preserve the topsoil, and to recharge groundwater so that our streams and everything will flourish, will become perennial. So these are some of the things we're trying to do there. We have wildlife, and once in 10 years we have elephants that come through. It hasn't happened for the last 10 years. We have deer, we have wild hogs, wild buffaloes sometimes. We have occasionally some type of species, I don't know what they are, some type of canine species, maybe tigers, panthers, leopards, whatever, some kind of species like that, that come. Bears, we started making honey, but then we stopped. Because the bears, you know, they have a very powerful sense of smell, and they can sense honey anywhere, and they really go for it when they have honey. So that's what we're trying to do. We have a long way to go. We're nowhere near achieving our goals. But as I quoted from the Bhagavad Gita, that yes, the success is in our effort in line with what Krishna wants. The modern industrial civilization has, to use the language I hear here, blown it. We've made a mess of our society. Yes? Despite all this so-called advancement and all the success and sophistication and polish of the modern civilization, we've really blown it. That's why you have so many people committing suicides despite being successful. Okay, so that was a brief description of our place.
Is this the same place that some yoga retreats come to, like Bhakti Yoga DC? They go to an eco retreat?
Oh, that's near Bombay. That's a different one. That's different. That's way ahead of us. We are very rustic in comparison. I'll tell you another secret, that we didn't even have toilets till I insisted upon it. They would go into the forest. But then it became really difficult. So then I saw people were finding it difficult because sometimes it gets cold, it's raining, you're sick, you have to go into the forest, it's difficult. It also happened because somebody heard a roar when he went into the forest and he packed up his bags and left the next day. So I didn't want any reverse migration to happen. So then I said, no, at least, come on. So I had to persuade them, come on, you have to, at least toilets. Let's have compost toilets. So we don't have all the flushing type of push button types of things now. Just ordinary compost toilets, just the way our ancestors lived years and years ago. Simple, natural.
Do you have lots of kirtan happening?
Morning and evening. But you see, we have a small crew there. We have about 15 people. And because it's a farm, so there's hard work. You have to be out there working all day with the cows, with the bulls, with construction, with farming, with cooking, and so on and so forth. So one day perhaps we'll be able to have it, a lot. Now it's just morning and evening, the morning program, and then in the evening everyone gets together. And the food is delicious there, by the way. It's very simple. Very simple. But it's delicious. Any final question before we wind up? Yes.
Could you just give your definition of meditation?
Can you please repeat that?
Could you give your own definition of meditation?
Okay, could I define the term meditation? Meditation, according to the scriptures, means to focus the mind on God. Actually, it means focusing on any object, generally. The idea of meditation is to have the mind focused or concentrated. But there is a certain verse in the scriptures that exactly explains what this is. Dhyanavasthit tad gatena manasa pashyantiyam yoginaha. It's a Sanskrit verse which means that the yogis, they meditate upon Krishna who is within the heart.
Can you explain this?
Sorry?
Can you explain this last phrase? I'm sorry, I'm curious.
Yeah, it means that the yogis, they focus their minds and they meditate on Krishna who is within the heart. So the same supreme entity Krishna is also living within our hearts along with the soul, guiding the soul. He's called the super soul. So to realize him within the heart is the real success of life. And he also has his own abode way beyond our material world. In that spiritual world, that's called Krishna's abode. So we want to go there. So meditation should take us there. I went into one place in India where there was a new place constructed for meditation, and we usually carry our chanting beads because on these beads we chant this Maha Mantra. You heard beautiful singing and chanting of this mantra, Hare Krishna Mantra. So we chant that on our beads as well, but I wanted to see this place since I was there. My host was very keen also I should go. So we went to this place and they asked us to keep away, aside everything that we were carrying. You have to go without anything, no mobile phones, that is fine. But they didn't want us to carry our chanting beads, so I obliged, although not happily. So we went inside that meditation room. It was quite a large room, a big dome. And then as soon as I entered, it was air-conditioned. And it had a thick carpet, it was dark, completely dark, except for one very, very dim light in the center, very dim. It took a while for the eyes to get accustomed to the darkness there. Then somehow we made our way without toppling over people because people were sitting everywhere. So then I found a space and I went and sat there. And as we settled down, then within a few minutes, I heard these sounds coming from various parts, you know, around, because it was very quiet, so you could hear sounds. And the sounds were... It was such a nice, soothing place to sit. Everybody was just sleeping. Not to say that everyone would be like that, but the point is that in this age, that kind of meditation is just not suitable. Our minds are not made for it. Few evolved people may be able to do it, but not for everyone. So therefore, very wisely, we have been recommended this mantra meditation. The word mantra is composed of two words, two parts, man and tra. Manaha means the mind. Tra comes from Sanskrit, from the Sanskrit word trayati, which means to deliver or to free from. So the word mantra means that which frees you from anxiety. And the Hare Krishna mantra is called the Maha mantra. The Maha means great. So it's the great mantra for deliverance. So when you chant this with feeling, with devotion, with attention, carefully pronouncing the words as well, then it gives a tremendous effect in the mind.